Hi, and welcome to the Webster University Geneva podcast. I'm Juliana Sandholm-Bark. Just over a year ago, I launched Meet the Artist, a public lecture series, an event where visual artists are invited to talk about their work and their creative process. To learn more about our program of lectures, please visit the link wcci.webster.ch/events/meet_the_artist. Today, I'm in the recording studio with Francesco Arezzo Visconti. Welcome, Francesco.
Hello.
Francesco, we've known each other for something like 10 years, and it's a real honor to interview you today. You do so many things for Webster. You're involved with the PhD project, teach a full load of classes, and oversee the media communications department and photography program, and you still find time to be on this podcast.
And have a family.
And have a family.
With two children.
Two children. And you still find the time to be an amazing and collaborative colleague.
Thank you.
Plus, you do amazing work with the students. You're always arranging for them to do things like document local events, like TEDx, Museo Mix. You do projects in collaboration with institutions like CERN and the Green Cross, to just name a few. And you just won the Thomas Kemper Award for Excellence in Teaching. So congratulations for that.
Thank you.
When did you first realize that you wanted to become a photographer?
Oh, God. you said I have to be short in my answers?
No, as long as you want. I mean, you know, within reason.
I'd say that art has been always flowing in my family somehow.
Your parents?
Well, they were not artists.
Okay.
So where's the art? Let's say that my dad, let's say they supported that aspect. Mm. And my dad was, still is, an architect. Mm. And I still remember when I was copying what he was doing. And
in drawings, you mean?
Yeah, drawings, basically, yeah. I think drawing has been the first way for me to express art. Mm. And maybe not music. And that's a regret that I have, but that's how it is. So photography. Photography arrived pretty late in my life. I have studied something different before.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what?
Archaeology. Mm. And so all my classical background comes from there, which I think helps a lot with what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. And even though I think there are a lot of similar things in photography and archaeology, I just realized that year after year thinking, because archaeology comes from something practical, because you have to dig and find evidence and then transform it into something intellectual. So, you know, an exhibition and then a publication or a course in a university, understanding a civilization. And photography to me comes from the evidence, from reality you have around you. You produce images, you produce something, and then from that you have to explain thinking, thoughts, procedures, and probably writing or bringing in into a classroom. So the connection is not that far, in my opinion. So I found this similarity. And photography came when I was given a photo camera as a gift. And I think it happened because my wife and I went on, she was not my wife at the time, we went on holidays. Mm-hmm. And I brought with me a small point-and-shoot camera, film point-and-shoot camera, just to take some photographs of our trip. And when we came back, my wife was pretty clear in her judgment of those photographs, which were, in her opinion, horrible. Mm. And so I said, okay, I have to improve this. So everything, I think, started from there, more or less. Mm-hmm. It's a few years ago now. Yeah. Quite a few years ago.
So when did you launch your freelance photographer career?
You want to know the year?
Yeah, like more or less, just to sort of...
Well, it's probably around now 20 years ago, 20, 25 years ago.
Is it correct to say that your early work focused more on buildings than on human beings?
Definitely, yes. That's been a switch. I think my focus was mainly on something not moving much. Sorry, I forgot to. yes, maybe because of I don't know the reason why, but it's true. I was photographing more still life, architecture, and landscape, which is somehow still life. We went to India, which is quite well populated, and my wife told me that I was one of the few people managing to photograph India with no people in my images, which is quite true. And then something happened a few years ago. So I've done some projects.
Can we talk about them before we move on to discussing your work with human beings?
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you because your early projects, so you published a lot of books. Are you published like something like 30 books to date? That's what I found somewhere
30
online.
30 books? No, yeah. They're not 30 books.
Okay, well, 30 projects
maybe 30
were mentioned. Okay, well, you published quite a few. For example, you published something in 2004 on the relationship between human construction and the environment in the Greek islands, something we've never discussed. And I wanted just to ask you a little bit about that. Was that, you know, the first time you discovered Greece or not even, because I know you have a relationship with Greece that's ongoing. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting to find out about this. Could you tell us about
actually,
that
was a project I got also an award.
Yes.
Which is quite interesting.
It was so long ago, you forgot.
Yeah. That is a project that, okay, it was in 2006.
Six.
2006, okay. I think.
Maybe you worked on it and then you exhibited it in 2006 or something like that. Possible.
I think it was 2006 because my wife and I went to Paros. For 2 months and a half. It was from the 28th of February until the 6th of May of 2006. And I never managed to stay quiet, even if I don't have much to do, I find things to do. So I said, okay, I brought with me my large format camera, 8x10. And I decided to photograph basically archaeological sites or evidence on some, maybe two, Greek islands, Paros and Naxos. And again, with no human beings, but what was left by human beings. So I tried to discover what was found on Paros. So there was a little bit of research in the libraries and on Naxos, which was also a good excuse to discover the islands. And then I photographed and then processed the negatives and then made contact prints. And I think it was in 2007, I had an exhibition at the public library in on Paros. And then now my all the photographs of those projects are collected in the library in Paros.
I see. Nice. It would be good field trip for your students.
It would be a good field trip for my students, yes. Yes. And I think it's a good idea because it gives archival work in the proper place. And the aim of that work was to see the basically what was left by human beings on in the landscape. So trying to create this connection between the landscape and the interaction of the human being.
So looking at sort of the collapse of civilizations in that perspective.
Yes.
Was that always kind of a theme you're interested in?
Yes. Yes. And the transformation, how not in all the images, but in some of them, how actually nature incorporates some of these images. And then when I came back, I think the work came before the exhibition. I submitted the work to the Toscana Photo Festival in 2000. It was the end of 2006,
mm-hmm.
and it received an award for environment impact.
Ah, so this idea of nature reclaiming
yes.
human constructions.
Yeah.
Okay. And you also worked on, so you know, there are many aspects to your photography that focuses on buildings. You also worked on a book on the Italian photographer Giovanni Michelucci.
Mm-hmm.
So after you went to Greece, the year after, more or less, or
yeah,
something like that.
Which is actually what brings me to Paros, to Webster.
Oh, okay.
Because I started working on this project in collaboration with a publishing house in Florence, mm-hmm. and they asked me to work on the less known works of Giovanni Michelucci, who was a pretty important architect in Italy, but I would say in the European context, at least. And he was from Pistoia.
Mm-hmm.
In Florence, there's a foundation after his name. And so I got the support of the foundation and the city of Fiesole, where the foundation is.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an exhibition eventually of the photographs, which were part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And to that exhibition, I don't know how it happened, one faculty, Susan Stang, from Webster St. Louis, who loved Florence and was mm-hmm. in Florence in those years, came. We got in touch, we met, and I discovered Webster that time. And she invited me to be visiting photographer in Webster St. Louis. So it was my first visit in St. Louis without wow. being hired, without being in any way connected to Webster.
That's great. And you gave a talk there, or did you just visit?
I gave a talk. I met the students. And then there was also a small exhibition in the Washington University in St. Louis.
Hmm.
I think we spent a week there. It was when we were on Paros, because I remember we left from the Athens airport and we came back to the Athens airport. So we left from the Greek island to go to St. Louis.
Oh, wow.
And then we came back. So it was between February 28th and May the 6th of 2006.
And that was your first contact with sort of being in a classroom teaching, or?
No, because when I started working in Florence as a photographer,
mm.
Well, actually, I have to say, even when I was working as an archaeologist, I did a lot of presentation to students mm-hmm. in classes about our works,
mm-hmm.
I mean, our discoveries. So, okay.
Was it all Tuscany-based?
Mainly, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both the discoveries and the classes where I went to, the schools where I went to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to go to what kind of discoveries, but they were quite impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a time when you had to take the slides, you know, where you have a projector mm-hmm. with all the slides. And so my first experience in teaching or presenting, it was that one. Mm-hmm. And then in Florence, I started teaching courses, photo courses in American universities, basically. Mm-hmm. That's how I started improving my English, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I started teaching in these... first as short courses, and then with other universities like New York University, in Florence.
So it's interesting because you have such a Tuscany-based, you have strong roots, right, in Tuscany?
I would say
for
yes.
For real? Like you're a big fan of the Renaissance, right? I said it before you had a chance. Sorry. But so... when you think of teaching, a common heritage to, you know, people who are in Florence, who are looking at, you know, who are sort of ensconced in kind of Renaissance things, right? If you think of your experience teaching that in that context, and then I think if you think of teaching in the Webster context, which is very different, where the students have no common heritage as far as their backgrounds, what would you say, what does that do to your experience of teaching? Looking at these two contexts?
Well, I never taught two students in Tuscany coming from the same heritage. Because when I was there, I was teaching in American universities as well. So more or less, the context was the same.
So diverse, the students had a diverse background, cultural background?
I think it would be, well, definitely a different experience. But I've never done it, so I don't know how to handle it. I actually have to say that I like the idea that you have a variety in class, a diversity in class, because that gives you gives you the time to learn as well when you're teaching.
So then in 2010, following the chronology here, you worked on a project that documented the spatial relationships that regulate public squares and define monuments in Tuscany as architecture. Could you tell us more about that project, which sounds really exciting?
It was a pretty big work,
It was a commission, right?
Yeah, by the Kunsthistorisches Institut in Florence, Max Planck.
Yeah.
Which I would say that on the academic point of view, it's been the most important project that I have done, I would say, so far. And I'm not considering the PhD, but it's a different thing. That was commissioned. And somehow it's a pity that I left Florence because I was contacted by the Max Planck Institute in Florence. And I was in the process of moving to Switzerland. And when we started a project, I met the director, and they said, okay, eventually we find someone from Florence, because we always had photographers from abroad and it was always complicated to work with them. And actually, I thought, well, I'm moving right now, so it's going to be a complicated relationship as well. So that is a pity, because who knows? Maybe a collaboration could have continued, but who knows? Life is made of these decisions that you have to take. And but the project was extensive, long, complicated, because you had I had a long list of places that I had to photograph, and sometimes find the right light. They wanted to have that on a negative, black and white, large format. So it was intense, because you have to have a lot of negative holders to have all these shots available, and it was a way to discover my land, I would say, because I had to go around in the country for quite a lot of time, and it was good that I had a camping van already at the time, because I could sleep in places where the morning after, very early, I could start photographing. So it was good. I'm glad it's finished, because it was really, really intense.
Yeah. How much time were you on the road like that for this project?
I think it was eventually 2 years.
On and off, though, I imagine.
Yes, on and off. Going from here to there. It's been pretty, pretty intense. And technically and emotionally and as final results to deliver the final product, all the images have to be cleaned up. No, it's pretty, very intense. And then eventually there was a publication with some of the images, which are in the archives of the institute. I would say that, yes, it's been definitely, in terms of extension and course of the work, one of the most important things in my life so far.
So tell us how you discovered the human subject from there.
The human subject.
When was the first time you photographed people for a project? Or did you realize that there was potential to the human subject?
No, I think it's been because of two events. I went to, here at Webster, we have the WHA, the Webster Humanitarian Association. And they were doing this trip to Srebrenica every year. And I proposed to dissociation to go and maybe develop a photographic project on, I don't know even, actually I had no idea, but on something there. And I visited the place and I was shocked. But what I did, it was approaching the context in my usual way. So I photographed the context more than people.
Mm. So because again, it's sort of the remnants of human civilization, kind of?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Or the results of war.
Mm.
And then thinking about that and meeting virtually other photographers like Toscani, who is the photographer who also worked for, he's pretty known because of the work of he did for Benetton, mm-hmm. and his campaign centered on human beings.
He was there also?
No, where did you meet him? When I say met, it's virtually.
I
met him online reading some articles, okay. and seeing some photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And he said once that photography has a sense if it deals with the human condition.
Mm.
So putting these two things together, I said, well, you know, you reflect. And somehow the project of Srebrenica didn't happen, and I found an alternative. An alternative was concentrating on something that was around me. Not only around me, but it's in me, which is migration. And the Sparkling Light was the one of these boats that sunk in the Mediterranean, next to Lampedusa, mm. with a lot of people died. And I decided to work on something like that. But not on the process of moving,
mm.
mainly on the process of settling, mm. in the country and getting maybe integrated.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something in general that, yes, there are studies, there is a lot of work done on that process as well. And I decided to work on the African migration in Switzerland, or it was called in Switzerland, but actually it was in Geneva.
Mm-hmm. So the New World, the project, exactly. that became known as New, yes. World Stories of African Immigration.
Yes. And if I look at it now, it was also a way to try to develop something academic, but I have to say that probably, well, it's a self-critique, but it's probably superficial for what actually a project like that could be,
mm.
and should be.
How would you expand on it if you were to revisit?
Well, let's project? Say that in terms of structure, the project was it was a nice idea, photographing people in their apartments or homes,
right,
interviewing them and asking them in one sentence a piece of advice for people there in the process of moving to Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was good, and I also involved a student journalist,
mm-hmm.
to interview people. So it was a nice idea.
Mm-hmm.
To expand it, probably I think the what was missing was the theoretical background on photography and the relationship with the subject in a context like that, trying to understand more about the process of migration and the perception of it by the individual,
mm-hmm.
on the psychological point of view. So trying to go a bit more in depth before clicking the shutter.
Mm-hmm. So is that when storytelling and story collecting become an important part of your research process? This one project, or had you collected stories before?
Mm-hmm.
Was that the
yes.
first time?
Yes, it was the first time.
Because ever since this project, 2013, New World, you've been collecting stories as part of what your research process is,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So then we always think of photography as connected with words.
Mm-hmm.
published alongside the photograph,
mm-hmm.
and so you still think of those two as inextricably linked, the image on the one hand and the words?
I'm facing that aspect as well now with my PhD. I think the words are important in the process. Rancière actually studied or wrote about that. And there is it is important because you can redirect some of the elements that you want to deliver, some of the concept you want to deliver. So yes, definitely yes, text is important. If there's one in common, by the way, that I have to say between the projects I'm doing now and the works I've done before, it is true that they were not related to human beings. I mean, they didn't incorporate human beings in the picture. But the process of documentation is more or less the same. So it's kind of documentary approach, which is similar. It is storytelling, but in general, it's like a sequence, like an archival project. They're all more or less in the same way. Starting from the work in Greece, the work on Giovanni Michelucci, the other one for the Kunst Historisches Institute, and what I'm doing now, starting from the African migrants, and then the other projects later, and the PhD now. There's always the same kind of archival procedure, which I think comes from my archaeological background, classification.
We haven't talked about your amazing project where you photographed the Italian Chinese community living in Prato between 2012 and 2014. And you just mentioned documentary photography, which, so two separate projects came out of the time you spent photographing, if I'm not mistaken. One project was called We Prato, which was more documentary. And the other, Hidden Identity, was more photojournalistic. So I've studied you well. But so I was going to ask you, what are the differences for you when you work on a project in documentary photography versus a photojournalistic project?
That's a very interesting question, because it's about the difference between photojournalism and documentary photography, which is quite debated in these days. Because of the, if you think about the roots of photojournalism and documentary photography, if you go back to Walker Evans and the Farm Security Administration work, where people say that a certain kind of documentary photography started with large format camera and making a classification of events, trying to be the most objective possible. Then it made sense, because using a large format camera, as Walker Evans was doing, brings you to have a certain kind of relationship with the context and individuals in front of you. Photojournalism, of course, when you're doing photojournalism, when you were doing photojournalism, like war context, you were not using large format cameras in the same years when Walker Evans were using the large format cameras for the Farm Security Administration. So, of course, when you're using a smaller camera, you have a totally different mobility, a different way of seeing, a different way of approaching things. Therefore, your final result is different. And you can perceive it in the images. In these days, yes, you can still use large format cameras. You can still use a smaller camera. You can use a phone to document. And probably and the final result will be different still. So if there is a differentiation that I can find between photojournalism and documentary photography, is the approach, more than the technical aspect in these days. Because I'm using, for instance, DSLR, a digital camera, for my PhD, as I'm using, as I would use, a large format camera. So I put it on a tripod, And I put live view, so I see on the screen the image in front of me to create an image and a distance with the subject.
Mm.
And that's where, in my opinion, the documentary approach starts. It's your relationship with the subject and the context more than the tool in these days.
Mm-hmm.
As if you were using a large format camera.
Mm.
So it's not. It started with objects like cameras,
mm-hmm.
with a certain kind of approach, but in these days, I think that it moved from the object itself,
mm-hmm.
to a way of thinking and way of acting as if you had those objects. So it's a different way of seeing.
Mm-hmm. So what's the secret to taking a good photograph of a person?
I'm still trying to find it. It doesn't mean that I have it. So,
but it's, you agreed that building a connection is crucial to taking a picture of a person in the documentary context, right? If you're there with your large format camera pointing at a person, you have to have, don't you always have to have a connection, or sometimes not? How do you decide when to shoot? I'm thinking of the We Prato project right now. I'm visualizing some of those photographs where, you know, maybe if you could use that as an example, I don't know.
Let's say that there are different photographers and different ways of acting in taking portraits. There are some people, they say, and I'm not talking about my work in general, there's some people, they say, you don't need to know your subject to take a good portrait.
Mm-hmm.
You better not know your subject to take a good portrait, because mm-hmm. you are not too much involved in the human connection, and you portray these people in an objective way.
Mm-hmm.
There are other people, they say, you better know your subject as much as you can, so mm-hmm. that you actually can take out of the image the inner part of the identity
mm-hmm.
of that subject.
So which camp do you locate yourself in?
I think that when I started with the photographing buildings, my idea was not to be much connected with a person.
Mm.
But it's a matter of fact that I am ending up and all the time interviewing people.
Right, so how can you not get to know them, right?
Yes. So what I've done in starting with the project with people coming from Africa,
mm-hmm.
and then in Prato, and even now, I can't avoid to interview them.
Mm-hmm. Unless you could outsource it, but it's...
Yeah, but it's not
then
the same.
Then you lose control of what you're doing, of course.
Then we have to see if that is coming through the images.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that the project on African migration, yes. We Prato, definitely yes. I think that it came out. There's a strong connection with the young subject that I photographed there.
Mm-hmm.
The work I'm doing now, my PhD, I think that everything I discussed in the interview doesn't come out of the photographs. That's why I'm developing a new idea. And trying to include extra elements to communicate a story, or trying to communicate something to the viewer. But definitely the connection with the subject is quite important, yes.
Mm. Are there examples of photographs you've taken and shown where you had a very strong sense that there was a link between you and the subject that was very perceivable, and then when you talked to somebody else who looked at the photograph, they didn't see that link? Because you could argue that everything is a matter of projection, right? So since you were so hugely invested in the process,
yes.
you project, but then are there photographs? I mean, is it an objective thing that comes across, this connection between the person portrayed and the viewer of a photograph? Would you say there's an objective quality to that intensity, or is it all subjective?
That's how my PhD started. And that's how I developed it. And that's why I'm changing it. Because it was a way, you know, a PhD is a journey, as my supervisor always says. And this is happening. It started with this idea, a photograph of Italian migrants in Switzerland, and in 2015 it started, not a PhD, but this project somehow. And I asked them to have in their hands something related to their own identity. And they could actually have any kind of expression, facial expression they wanted to have, they could have. And of course, these are all messages for the viewer. The object, face, they're communicating their personality. which came, all these aspects came out of the interview somehow. And that's why when I started the PhD, I said, okay, I have to photograph Italian migrants, but I want to create this connection. I want to push the dialogue between the viewer and the subject a bit farther. I don't want to be this kind of Deus ex machina who is directing the dialogue in a certain direction. And telling the viewer already what he needs to think through the image. So I created these images which are kind of like totems, like kudos, statues with no facial expression. And the viewer looks at these images and says, okay, I have not too many elements to interpret what I see. And that really happened, the fact that they don't have much. That's why now I'm thinking to change a few things, because that was a nice experiment that really got what I wanted to. The viewer looks at these images and they bring in their own interpretation of what they have in front of them. They have no clue, basically.
Yeah, you don't help them with any kind of codified objects, kind of like the props you used to use for your genus exhibition, right?
Yes, yes, exactly.
So you abandoned the props in the photographs.
I abandoned the props in the photographs.
Yeah.
And I did it for basically 2 years.
Yeah.
And eventually I said, okay, but they are images of Italians, and the Italianity doesn't come through because there's nothing about that.
Well, it's maybe invisible.
It's invisible. And that's the result of this first stage of the research, that I produce, just to highlight how globalization is making us very similar in Europe. Let's say the way we dress, the way we appear. There are differences, of course, but they're subtle because we are more globalized than in the 1960s, when there were photographs taken here in Switzerland of Italian migrants who clearly were dressed differently from the local people. And also the way these Italians appear visually, their physiognomy was different than today. And today you can have a Swiss or an Italian or a German or a French who are similar in the way they look.
Yeah.
So in May, I had a meeting with my supervisor and said, I told him that I wanted to expand the project and add something. So I wanted basically to introduce a prop somehow, but not in their hands. So I want to keep the subject the way I photograph him or her, and include an element of their cultural identity which is in their houses, and I started already, and the results are interesting. So basically, I want to put like 2 pages of a book. On one page, you're showing that we are globalized, apparently, and we are all similar and kind of invisible, and there's not an apparent diversity. And then the back of the page, you have an image where this cultural identity is passing through because everyone is choosing different objects. and it's telling something about their own cultural background, mm-hmm. which is going to be different.
So is it a return to the prop? Sort of, is it sort of rapprochement, you know, going back to the project which you exhibited in Milan, at the expo in Milan, in the Swiss Pavilion?
It is somehow going back to the prop. Mm-hmm. I thought about how to develop, or how to give a hint to the viewer about the cultural background of the subject represented. Mm-hmm. And I saw a documentary about Federico da Montefeltro, who was a Renaissance, the Renaissance Duke of Urbino.
Mm-hmm. Who had that amazing rotunda, right? The oculus. Wasn't that where the ceiling was painted and the little putti was sort of looking over the balcony?
I don't remember.
Maybe there's some... It's just amazing buildings all over that area, so I don't know if it's that one.
I think I know what you're talking about, but I don't think it's in Urbino.
Really? Okay, gotta relook.
But maybe yes. Oh no. Anyways, but I'm sure you know the portrait of the Duke of Urbino, yeah. in the Uffizi Gallery.
In profile.
In profile, yeah. Yes. With the land in the background, which is something I got inspired already for my research. Mm-hmm. About the landscape and Renaissance portraiture. Mm-hmm. So the Duke of Urbino had his little studio, mm-hmm. in the palace in Urbino, in the Palazzo Ducale in Urbino. And in this studio, he has... everything is carved and made in wood in the walls. So basically it's, I don't know how to say it in English, but it's cut and, you know...
Carved?
Well, it's not only carved, but it's actually cut and created on the walls, and it's painted with wood, but it's not painted. It's pieces put together like a mosaic. Okay. But it's not a mosaic.
It's like a collage of some kind or a...
Yeah. I'm sure there's an English word for that. Anyways, and in this studio, on the walls, you have represented everything which was important for him. So his cultural identity is there. Mm. So books, music instruments, his armor, when it was, because he was a soldier. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you see, after 500 years, almost 600 years, we still understand his personality because of the objects represented in his studio. Mm.
So, but is the studio authentic, or was it sort of recreated by later historians?
No. Yes.
And it's documented?
Yes. Basically, he represents his passions. Mm. So there's a book of Seneca, a book of Cicero, you know, so he showed that he was reading also certain kind of... literature. Mm. So I said, okay, maybe we can do something similar. And passing the idea of a cultural identity through an object which is going to be represented in their houses. Mm-hmm. So that's the next stage. And it will include also text. Because in my interviews now, I'm asking, what's the object that you chose? And tell me why you chose that object. Mm-hmm. So basically, in the caption, in an exhibition or in a book, I can include the words defining the choice.
Yeah, so you'll have the artifact somehow back in the portrait.
Yes.
And the materiality of that object is has significance too.
Yes, so basically I'm creating kind of an installation. Mm. It's not one photograph anymore. It's two photographs plus a text. And when I say installation, because if you want, one way of exhibiting could be you enter a room and you see all these portraits hanging from the ceiling, for instance, and you meet these people. And then if you go in the back of the room and you turn your head, you see all these objects. Mm-hmm. So the two images, maybe they can be presented.
So they'll be like diptychs.
Yes.
Presented next to each other.
I was thinking more on the next one behind the other.
Okay.
So when you enter a room, you actually see the front.
Mm.
But then when you end up looking at all these people, you turn your head and you see all these objects significant objects for their cultural identity.
Mm. It'd be interesting to do an exhibition on intransparencies again with, windows. Then mm-hmm. you could position one photograph and then a little bit further away on glass,
mm-hmm.
the same person.
Yeah.
And you'd sort of look through both,
mm-hmm.
maybe, mm. to try it. So it sounds like your PhD is constantly evolving.
It's a beast that continuously changing. It's going to become big and huge.
Maybe this is just the beginning, and it's going to become more and more complex. Each photograph is going to have multi-layers by the end.
Yes, I think that the layers are adding one on top of the other. And I think that's the goal of the PhD, to add layers.
Because it's sort of, you've given yourself kind of an impossible task almost, you know, representing cultural identity, right? That's sort of the goal.
Yeah.
And how do you represent?
Well, the idea initially was...
Such an ineffable quality, right? Yeah. It's such an essential thing.
The idea at the beginning was to represent a national cultural identity of Italians.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So including the landscape, a certain kind of lighting, a certain mm-hmm. kind of position of the body, recalling Renaissance painters.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way to connect the viewer with a certain historical moment.
Mm-hmm.
But then the individual disappears and you know nothing about the individual. So I'm bringing back information of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
With this escamotage, with mm-hmm. this system of the including an object of their choice, representing not their identity, but their cultural identity, mm-hmm. which is something sometimes confusing
mm-hmm.
for some of them, because they're thinking of something about important for them, but not necessarily representing their cultural background. So they're being Italian or not Italian, partially Swiss, because I'm including also second generation Italians.
Mm-hmm.
Who might feel Italian, but maybe not 100%.
So the artifacts will vary. Some of them will be linked to Italy and others won't.
We'll see.
Yeah. It's so you're like really leaving it open to them to decide.
It's like research. I'm going to collect data. And at that point, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
It might be that in some cases, it happens for my children who grew up here.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday I was telling them, you know, regardless of the fact that you're thinking that you're only Italian, you're not only Italian.
Mm.
You're also Swiss.
Mm-hmm.
And my older one was not particularly happy about this. But I said, it's a matter of fact. That's how you are.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more Swiss than I am, definitely,
mm-hmm.
because of my life experience.
For kids, it can be very difficult to hear.
Yes.
I remember being very rebellious in that way too.
Yeah.
My parents were sort of...
My son was very rebellious yesterday.
Telling me, you know, you're the most Swiss of us, of the mm-hmm. family. It was very hard to hear because mm-hmm. my heart was elsewhere.
Yeah. And I'm sure Andre, my son, is the same. So, but one way... could also be, but this is just expecting something, but it's not understood. That's in some cases, some people will show me something for them representing their Italianity, which is exaggerated or seen from outside,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of the different kind of experience of this Italianity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like when you have the cliché of Italianicity, what Barthes mentioned as Italianicity, which is what a tourist would expect to be Italian.
Right.
It's the cliché of being Italian, which is not only Italian. It can be, you know, Germanicity, Englishness, you know. It's cliché. So if you ask an Italian what Swiss would be, they for sure answer, you know, cheese, banks, mountains, cows. The cliché.
Mm-hmm.
And Switzerland is not only this. me as an Italian, I was surprised to see when I came here that they have vineyards. I said, did they make wine in Switzerland? Is that possible? Of course, you have cliché. So in some cases, I think that it might be that some people, they have an expanded citizenship. When I say expanded, because actually to me it is a positive aspect being multicultural, they might have a different version of what Italy is to me, you know. But we'll see. Who knows? Yeah. But it could pass through the objects. It could.
It'll be an exciting project to watch develop.
Well, it is happening, yes.
When is your next exhibition?
October.
Can you tell us more?
Yes, it's going to be at the Centre des Arts of the Equilant NGB for 1 month long. Initially, the idea was to have the working process of the PhD. But then it might be that this working process of the PhD could be exhibited in a different place next year. So I don't want to have two exhibitions of the same subject in a short distance. So I propose to actually have kind of a retrospective of my work on migrants. So have a selected images from the work on African migration in Switzerland, selected images from the Italian-Chinese project, and maybe some images from the Genus project when I exhibited at Expo, and maybe a couple of images of the PhD, not too many, just to show like the process of growth in that field. I think it's going to be interesting.
Is it the first time you're going to see yourself in you know, four different eras of your work, and it might give you some new insights too to see it like that?
It's going to be interesting to see the development of the photographic language. So as a photographer, but most of all I would say as a human being. I think there's a lot of development under the point of view how you say in French, a prise de conscience. I think that's happening more and more, and who knows where it's going to go.
And that's, so how many pieces are going to be exhibited? Do you know already, more or less?
I think the idea is to have like three from Stories of African Immigration in Geneva, three from Wiprato, three from Hidden Identity, three from Genus, and maybe only one from the PhD.
Okay.
So that makes...
I haven't been counting.
But around 15 images, something like that.
So I look forward to seeing that.
And then I want to exhibit also a video that my students made in Prato.
Okay.
That's going to be interesting to see it.
Yeah.
Which is online, and I think it's going to be interesting to put together all these things. All these, thanking to WCCI, the Webster Center for Creativity
and Innovation. So thank you so much for speaking with me, and I look forward to the next installment so we can continue this conversation one day.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here.